Now, continuing in our pursuit to deny ignorance, the following is a special edition of the ATS Mix. Now, here's Dave Rabbit.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to this special edition of the ATS Mix Show. I'm Dave Rabbit. We're going to be interviewing a very special guest today, Mr. Jerry E. Smith. With three mass-market nonfiction books under his belt and successful speaking engagements from Brisbane to the Bahamas, Jerry E. Smith is an overnight sensation that has been more than three decades in the making. His career as a writer, researcher, activist, editor, and lecturer began with the first professional sale of his writing back in 1969. In 1991, Mr. Smith and Jim Keith, author of Black Helicopters Over America, Strike Force for the New World Order, and numerous other conspiracy and mind control books, founded the National UFO Museum, NUFOM, in Reno, Nevada. From 1991 to 1994, Mr. Smith was the executive director of NUFOM, while Mr. Keith acted as the chairman of the board. In addition to his administrative duties of running the day-to-day operations of NUFOM, Mr. Smith also edited and wrote for that organization's quarterly journal, Notes from the Hangar. At the same time, Mr. Smith worked as an editor, graphic artist with Jim Keith's magazine, Dharma Combat, the magazine of spirituality, reality, and other conspiracies, until Jim's untimely death in 1999. Jerry served variously as managing editor and art director from Dharma Combat's inception in 1988. Mr. Smith's lifelong political and environmental activism and research has resulted in the publication of scores of news stories, opinion pieces, and books and movie reviews for local and regional magazines and newspapers throughout the western states. Mr. Smith's work has also appeared in such national publications as Fate Magazine and Paranoia, The Conspiracy Reader. And if you would please welcome our guest today, Mr. Jerry E. Smith, right after this commercial message from one of our sponsors. Dave Rabbit here again with the ATS Mix Show from AboveTopSecret.com. If you love politics and are tired of hearing and reading all that robotic crap that keeps churning out from the mainstream media, then come join me and thousands of people from around the world at AbovePolitics.com. They have political forums for everyone's taste, including U.S. politics, United Kingdom politics, Canadian politics, head-to-head political debates, politics of war. They have a general chit-chat and a freshman forum for you newbies and rookies to the political arena. There's also forums about Mideast conflict, socialism. They have a slugfest, liberalism, conservatism, moderate, and my personal favorite, military and security issues. So if you don't want to be another sheep and want to be a unique thinker, AbovePolitics.com is for you. Part of the Above Network, LLC. Deny apathy. AbovePolitics.com.
The following is an ATS Mix exclusive interview.
These aren't the right wristbands.
Yes, they are.
Okay, Jerry, well, thanks again for joining us here on the special edition of the ATS Mix. How are you, sir?
I'm good, and thanks for having me.
Well, you're very welcome. I tell you, I've been really excited about this, and so is the membership here at AboveTopSecret.com, because of all the different topics that you cover. I mean, it's just an amazing, amazing site. And I want to, before we ever get started here, is to mention your website, which I'd like all the members and all the fans of the AboveTopSecret.com and the ATS Mix Show to go to www.jerryesmith.com. That's JerryEsmith.com, and see what Jerry has to offer. Well, Jerry, you know, before we even get started, I mean, we could sit there and probably have to go out and get lunch and dinner to do everything that you guys you're capable of doing here. But let me ask you, you know, when you were a kid, Jerry, and you were growing up, you know, was there anything in your life that you can look back on and say, okay, well, God, this is really interesting, and that maybe was kind of the foundation that got your fire started on what you enjoy doing today?
Well, I guess it started in the third grade. I read a Robert A. Heinlein juvenile, Have Spacesuit, Will Travel, and it really tire-jacked my eyes open, made me see a whole new world. And between third grade and sixth grade, I read every sci-fi book in the local library. By the time I had graduated from high school, I had read more than 10,000 science fiction books. And I know that because a buddy of mine was Forrest J. Ackerman, or is Forrest J. Ackerman. He was the editor of Famous Monsters of Filmland. And at one time, he had the world's largest personal collection of sci-fi, fantasy, memorabilia, and so forth.
Wow.
And I went to his house a few times, and one time I was there, I noticed that all the hardbacks and the incredible memorabilia, like he had the female robot from the movie Metropolis and one of King Kong's heads in his dining room. And I asked him where the paperbacks were, and he said, "Oh, they're out in the garage." And I said, "Oh, cool. How many paperbacks are? How many titles are out there?" And he said, "He'd lost track, but he thought it was around 12,000 or 14,000." And I spent the afternoon. I spent about 4 hours digging through the garage, and I found about 300 books I had not read.
Oh, wow. Well, were you a fan? I mean, I was a big comic book guy when I was growing up, and I'm 59, so I mean, I was born in 48. So, you know, that's back in DC Comics and all the Superman, Batman, and Flash, and Green Lantern, and all those guys. And I really got hooked on that kind of fantasy of, if you will, science fiction to a degree. Not maybe the same that you're talking about. Did you ever get hung up on all that stuff?
No. I was reading adult novels about the same time I discovered comic books, and really had no interest in them at all. I'm not really very visual, which is sort of an awkward state in that I started off at wanting to be a fine arts painter. Actually, I started off because of the influence of Heinlein. One of Heinlein's characters that I really liked, the hero in Glory Road, was an architect. And so I wanted to become an architect. So in school, I took drafting and architecture classes, and I had a teacher who I just despised, and I could not stand another minute in that guy's class. So I changed over to fine art, and I was a fine artist for a while. And at one point, I realized that I really didn't have the patience to learn all the techniques necessary to make painting work. And at that same exact moment, 1969, I sold my first professional sale in writing and went, "Oh my gosh, I can describe the scene a heck of a lot easier, quicker, and better than I can paint it," and shifted from pictures to words.
Wow. And you know, it's interesting that you say that, because my history is I hated to read as a kid, still do as an adult. You know, I'm a visual guy, and you're actually 180 degrees from what I am, because you can sit there on, and this is the thing I admire about authors, Jerry, and I got to tell you, you know, I can't even imagine the patience that it takes. And of course, you have a love for it, obviously, but to sit there and write things in a way to where when people that love to read, not Dave Rabbit, but the people that love to read, they sit there and they can visualize what your mind is creating. That's what I've always found amazing about authors.
Well, thank you. That is a big piece of it. You know, we are storytellers. First and foremost, a writer is a storyteller, and it doesn't matter whether he's writing the great American novel or a Honda automobile mechanics guide. You're telling the story, whether the story is how to recalibrate the universe or how to recalibrate your carburetor.
Well, I've never thought about that. Well, listen, before we get into your books, I want to talk about some of the things that the membership can find on the JerryEsmith.com website. And I found some really neat things. And on some of these, I want to maybe touch base on the thing and maybe ask you if there's some of your choice that you want to talk about also. But one of them that really caught my eye was an article that you wrote that says, "Star Trek, Sci-Fi or Sci-War?" What do you mean by that?
What I did is I did an analysis of the names of the characters in the original Star Trek series. And I realized that these names were significant. They were meaningful. That in Victorian novels, you often had the characters names were a key point, like Oscar Wilde's the importance of being earnest. You know, it's very important to be earnest in several senses. You know, a lot of Victorian novels had characters like an effeminate dandy was Mr. Flup and Flutter. So I got to looking at the names in Star Trek and went, oh my gosh! And as some examples here, Captain Kirk, James Tiberius Kirk, Kirk K-I-R-K is the most common spelling in Europe of the word we know as church. Tiberius,
wow.
Roman general and emperor. James,
right.
Brother of Jesus. Roman Church, Roman Catholic Church.
Right, right.
The big feud on the flight deck was between the Vulcan, Mr. Spock, and the Dr. McCoy. McCoy, the real McCoy. The feud between the Hatfields and the McCoys, in which the Hatfields were eliminated by the McCoys.
Right.
Spock, Benjamin Spock, the baby doctor. Mr. Spock probably represents Benjamin Spock, the anti-authoritarian authority who was huge during this era and set a style for how to raise your children, which he later admitted was all wrong and apologized for. The doctor, McCoy, is attended by Nurse Christine Chapel. Christine, a variant of Christ. Chapel, a small church. It goes on and on and on like that. In fact, the Enterprise itself, NCC 1701.
Right.
The military have used secret names for their operations for a very long time. The
right.
Spanish Armada was codenamed the Enterprise. And the purpose of the Spanish Armada was to wrest England, from the apostate witch queen Elizabeth, back into the bosom of the Roman Catholic Church. And 1701 is the date that a lot of historians say is the true beginning of the World War that has yet to end. That 1701 began... that was the War of Spanish Secession, in which eventually all of Europe was embroiled in this war, and everything that has gone on since has been respites and reprises from this endless tussle for who is going to be in the catbird seat in Europe.
Yeah. Wow. You know, I tell you, when I first saw this, Jerry, it really kind of blew me away because I'm going, wow, Star Trek, because I'm I don't know if I would call myself a Trekkie or not, but I have, I got really into the original series, and then, of course, I really got into The Next Generation, and, of course, all the movies that came up, so it just really struck me as something that I saw real interesting, and when I read it on your website at jerryesmith.com, I saw this article, and I mean, I read the whole thing. I know. They say, Dave read. Yes, I did read this. It was not that long. There weren't any pictures, but I was able to get all the way through it. But I just thought that was an amazing little article, and how your take on it really expanded that.
Right. What I found after writing it was that, indeed, Gene Roddenberry had been raised Catholic, and had written a lot of the parameters of the show. And what I posit in the article is it possible that Star Trek was actually a psychological warfare event, that it was an attempt to condition the American public to accepting the Roman Catholic Church as the divine ruler of the cosmos. And I didn't think it was true, but I thought there were so many coincidences here that I should follow up these coincidences, and it did make a great article. And then in learning about Roddenberry, I realized that this was probably his subconscious coming through his writings, coming through his production of this show.
Right. All right, now you have several others that really kind of interested me, but one of them kind of jumped out at me because I really enjoyed the movie. Now this is where I watch a movie, but you're doing a review on the movie of Space Cowboys, for instance, and one of your lines is, "If you would like essentially mindless entertainment," you're talking to the choir there, Jerry. "You will enjoy Space Cowboys. There are a few meaningful, thought-provoking subjects brought up, but they're glibly skipped over, so there's no real blinds in the audience in fear being accidentally forced to think. The dialogue is arguably the best part of the Space Cowboy movie. It's quick, smart, and funny. The rest is, well, ripe stuff." How long have you been doing movie reviews?
Oh, boy. You know, I don't really know. My guess would be sometime in the mid-60s.
Really?
I came up in science fiction fandom in amateur publishing. I was actively involved in amateur publishing from 1966 to where you could say, up until very recently. In fact, some people point at my publisher and say, "Aha, he's still at it." But I've been involved in amateur publishing my entire life, and so or amateur or semi-professional publishing my entire life. So I probably had 200 movie reviews written and printed before I got my first check for one.
Right. Well, you know, I tell you, before we get into the books, and we're fixing to get into the books, but you know, I queried anybody that had any questions, and of course they all are going to be pretty much everything we're going to cover in the books, but there was one guy here on AboveTopSecret.com who his member name is Chakotay, which is it's interesting. His name is Chakotay, which is one of the sequels of the Star Trek movie series.
The captain of the Maquis ship.
Exactly. All right, and it says, I don't know. I mean, he's evidently done his homework on it. He says, "Jerry's hunting for babes, ladies." And then he clicked this link, and then, of course, it goes, "Welcome to my Lonely Hearts Club page on your website." And then he says something. Let's see what it goes to. It goes, then he says, "My question, Jerry, is this. Do you think psychotronic weapons cause your prolonged loneliness?" So I'll just leave it at that. Do you think the psychotronic weapons cause your prolonged loneliness that you portray in your Lonely Hearts Club article on your website?
Wow, now that's a pretty whack question.
Isn't it wacko? I mean, I love the members. They always come up with this, you know, this edge thing.
You know, I'm tempted to give a glib answer, but what the hell? I'll try to be serious.
And then can I have your glib one?
Yeah. Well,
let's have both of them. Let's have the one that you would do if it was live, and then let's have the glib one, which I will probably prefer.
Well, I don't know about if it's psychotronic weapons. The psychotronic weapons aimed at the citizenry of America, because I won't go so far as to say that I'm abnormal, though practically everybody else listening will. I'm not the cookie cutter. I'm not average. Some would say sub average, perhaps. I'm definitely different. I don't march to a different drummer. I took the drummer out and shot him years ago.
Me too.
You know, so it's like, if you are a nice, normal, average American, you're probably going to run screaming from me, at least while in a dating situation.
Right.
Not that I would do anything wrong. It's just, you know, I don't go to church on Sunday.
Neither do I.
I don't respect my elders.
Well, I respect some.
Yes, I respect those who actually did something respectful. You know what I mean? Who actually...
Right, oh, yeah.
You know,
oh,
you
yeah.
know I do not respect the president merely because there is some puppet pushed into the chair.
Right. All right, well, what's your glib response to this guy?
Ah, ah, ah.
Now keep in mind, even though we're streaming, we are FCC compliant.
I'll pass on that one.
Okay, yeah, we'll just leave that to the minds of the listener then. All right, well, enough of that guy. Anyway, all right, let's get your books, which is the main thing. I mean, the membership is really clamoring to hear, you know, all the different things that you have to say about your books. And I'm going to start with Secrets of the Holy Lance, the Spear of Destiny and History and Legend. Tell me about your motivation for this book.
Well, let me. I'm going to have to do sort of an end run around you on this. And
good.
And
I love end runs.
Set up what happened. That was my middle book. I was, from age 12 on, I wanted to grow up to be a science fiction writer. And I, from my first professional sale was a sci-fi sale. It was a short story.
Well, tell me about it then.
No. So, okay. for the next 69 to 84, I am trying to break into the sci-fi market and not doing very well because science fiction has the highest standards and the lowest pay. And it's very difficult to break in, and most publishers only want completed manuscripts, and every year the manuscripts get longer and longer and longer because the prices of the books keep getting more and more expensive, so you have to write bigger and bigger and bigger books to justify, and trilogies and pentologies. And eventually it all changed for me. I got into writing nonfiction. I got into doing ghostwritten books. And initially, I was helping people correct horribly unpublishable novels. And then I helped a couple of people do some nonfiction work. And I suddenly found my voice, found my stride, and actually started getting checks for my writing. And one of the pieces is on my website, A History of Ranchera.
I saw that.
William F. Hara, the casino magnate's son, John Hara, hired me to write a history of the family ranch, which is an amazing place owned by incredible people. And so that history of his ranch is on my site. And that really got me the feeling that I knew what the heck I was doing. And at the same time, I wrote a nonfiction book that has yet to be published called Toppling the Pyramid, A Practical Guide to Overthrowing the New World Order.
Right.
Now, while that was going on, I was also the executive director of the National UFO Museum in Reno, Nevada.
Right.
And I was editing the quarterly journal for the UFO Museum, and Jim Keith is my best friend, and Jim Keith wrote a dozen books before his untimely death in 1999. And we were editing a magazine together called Dharma Combat, the magazine of spirituality, reality, and other conspiracies.
Right.
And Jim's first couple of books grew out of Dharma Combat. And we acquired a copy of The Skeleton Key to the Gemstone File, which purports to be Bruce Roberts claimed that he invented the technique for making artificial rubies, attempted to sell it to Howard Hughes, who stole it from him. He then decided to get back at Howard Hughes by making his artificial rubies and selling them as though they were real ones to fund his research. And in researching Howard Hughes, he discovered that Howard Hughes was kidnapped by Aristotle Onassis and taken to his secret island, Scorpios, where he was killed, and that Onassis was the guy who actioned the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Now, this is all in about 1,000 letters that Roberts wrote to his mom. And it just happened that one day he hears May Brussel, the conspiracy queen, doing her weekly radio show, and went to her with these cardboard boxes filled with copies of these letters. And at that day that he appeared to give them to her, a young woman named Stephanie Caruana was there interviewing her, and Stephanie was a reporter for Playgirl magazine. And she offered to put them in order and write an overview of it. And that overview became known as the skeleton key to the gemstone file and has been circulating samizdat for decades. We got a copy of it, published it in Dharma Combat, and a fellow contacted us named Ron Bonds. And Ron had been collecting every copy of the skeleton key he could get his hands on. He got together with Jim, and together they produced a book. And Jim's first book was the Gemstone File, which was a series of articles analyzing whether or not this anything in here was true or not. And he had a number of articles from a number of key people, like Stephanie Caruana. Well, at the same time, we were doing Dharma Combat, which was getting really, really good and was really shaking up the underground and was really it was secretly famous. And Jim decided he wanted to go to a larger circulation. He wanted to go to a paperback format. He wanted to do it as a paperback quarterly and approached a number of editors. And Adam Parfrey at Farrell House was interested, but he didn't want to do it as a periodical. He wanted to do it as a one-shot. So it ended up coming out as Secret and Suppressed, Banned Ideas and Hidden History. So I helped write both of those books. And then Jim and I worked on each other's projects, helping each other. And at one point, Jim got a call from Ron Bonds saying, "HARP is the hottest thing on the internet right now. Can you write me a book on the subject?" And Jim said, "No, actually, I have four contracts right now. I'm packed up, but I have a friend." Jim put me in contact with Ron Bonds, and Ron and I worked out I would write a book about HARP for him, and that book was HARP, The Ultimate Weapon of the Conspiracy. Now, I wrote the first draft and sent it to Ron, and he hated it and canceled the project. And I sat on the manuscript for a year, not knowing what the heck to do with it. And then I remembered David Hatcher Childress at Adventures Unlimited Press. And I called David up, and as luck would have it, David was looking for a book on HARP and bought it on the spot, cut me a check right away.
Great.
We have sold over 20,000 copies of the book. It's been one of the best sellers this company ever had, of which I'm very grateful. Well, I immediately started work on the next book, which came out 7 years later. After 7 more years of research, it took me 2 years to research the HARP book. It took me another 7 years to research whether warfare, the military's plan to draft Mother Nature. Well, at one point while I was working on weather warfare, I got a call from David, and David had a small problem. There is this you may have maybe familiar with the book the Spear of Destiny.
Yes, I have heard of that.
Okay, right. The Spear of Destiny by Trevor Ravenscroft. It's been a perennial bestseller for about 20 years now, and there's a couple of follow up books to it that are very interesting, very strange, very hard to get now books by Dr. Howard Buchner. Dr. Howard Buchner was a teacher of medicine at Tulane and LSU, and he had been a battalion surgeon during World War II and had witnessed a massacre. I've momentarily forgotten the name of the camp, starting with the D, Dachau. He had witnessed the Dachau massacre, and if you're unfamiliar with the story, when the U.S. Army arrived to take over Dachau, they initially rounded up all the Germans and put them in one spot. Then they went into the camp and were horrified at what they saw, and they came out and they shot all the Germans, which of course dismayed Dr. Buchner. 30 years later, Dr. Buchner wrote a "I Was There, I Witnessed" book about it. Shortly after that book came out, he was approached by a submariner, a German submariner. And this German submariner said that he had been part of what today is known as the Führer convoy. It was a convoy of somewhere between 9 and 12 U-boats that left Germany in literally the last 2 or 3 days of the war. And this submariner had on his U-boat Martin Bormann and his entourage. And the Spear of Destiny.
Right.
And that they had dropped Borman off in Patagonia and then proceeded on to Antarctica, where they stashed the Spear of Destiny. Now, the Spear of Destiny is the spear that supposedly pierced the side of Christ as he hung on the cross and may be imbued with Christ magic thereby. And the Spear of Destiny was then taken to Antarctica and stashed in Antarctica. Further, this submariner claimed that in 1979, and this is what we're talking here now is what is like 10 years after that, in 1979, former members of Himmler's circle of Teutonic Knights gathered, reconvened the circle, and went to get the spear. And he helped them to recover the spear in 79, and he claimed to have the log of the expedition that went to Antarctica to get it, and photographs of objects that had come that had been along with it. And Buchner then researched this and was convinced that this guy was true, that this guy was right, that this really did happen, and wrote two books: Hitler's Ashes, Seeds of the of a New Reich, and Adolf Hitler and Secrets of the Holy Lance. Now, Buchner died about 1995 or so. I forget exactly when. After he died, all of his books were in storage in a storage unit in Louisiana. And the moisture in Louisiana was just destroying them, and the books were literally falling apart. And so David had been selling the books. And after Buchner died, he couldn't get any more, and the ones he did get were just in completely trash condition. And so he was selling, David was selling, but Adventures Unlimited Press was selling Trevor Ravenscroft's book, The Spear of Destiny, that he was getting from Samuel Weiser and only making a few cents per copy. Also, The Mark of the Beast, The Continuing Story of the Spear of Destiny by Trevor Ravenscroft and Tim Wallace Murphy, and we still have about eight copies of that one on the shelf, and these two books by Buchner, which he was quickly running out of. And so he called me and said, look, can you write me a book about the Spear of Destiny? And I said, well, look, I'm in the middle of weather warfare here, but the contract on weather warfare said I was supposed to give it to David in 1 year. This was 6 years ago. So I said, well, would this stop the clock? He goes, yeah, it'll stop the clock. I'll give you another year. Okay. Right? So then I had read Trevor Ravenscroft's book in the 1970s when it came out, and oddly enough, at the time, I was in a monastery. Please don't ask me. And so I
wait a minute. Stop the presses. You're in a monastery?
I was in a monastery, yes.
Were you trying to go into the monkhood?
Well, actually, I was in the monkhood, if you will.
Were you really?
Yeah.
What the hell are you doing in the monastery, Jerry? But your background doesn't really lend itself to that, does it?
Well, if you had read the For Ladies Only page on my website and got to the bottom of it, it would explain
it said
that.
For ladies only. I'm not a lady.
I do reveal a little bit of my past on the website. and I was raised a Lutheran. About 1964, at age 14, I completed catechism and began immediately to have doubts. I mean, one of the things that struck me is that I was in the Lutheran church that was built on the writings of Martin Luther, and they would not let me read the writings of Martin Luther. It wasn't anywhere in the catechism. It wasn't anywhere in the Sunday school. I kept asking the people at the church, where is this stuff that we're supposed to believe? And they kept saying, they kept putting me off and shoving me around. It's like, you don't need this. I was like, wait a minute. So finally, I actually did get a hold of the pronouncements of Martin Luther and went, oh my gosh, what he says is wrong with the church. I see going on in my church today.
Yeah, right.
Right. So that made me step back, and I watched too many Twilight Zone episodes, and was convinced I could cut a deal with the devil. So I spent about a year trying to conjure the devil so I could cut a deal with him. When he didn't show up, I said, oh, that's it. Obviously, he doesn't exist. Because, a 14-year-old boy is easy pickings if the devil were really there.
Oh, yeah, really.
You know? So I've been wandered through a whole bunch of Eastern philosophies. I went through the I Ching. I spent 10 years with the I Ching. I was a Taoist for a number of years. In fact, today I describe myself as a cross between a non-practicing Taoist and a quantum physicist who can't do the math. And in case that quantum physicist stuff doesn't ring a bell with you, let me explain. Niels Bohr's 1904 two-slit experiment seems to prove that the universe is conscious. The two-slit experiment allows this is how he got the Nobel Prize for physics that year, by proving that light was both a wave and a particle on the basis of which slit is open when you fire the photon. If you have two slots and you fire a whole bunch of photons, they spread out in a wave pattern, like they were a wave going through, and you get this cool wave pattern on the receiving plate. If you have one slot open and you fire one photon, it goes straight through, bang, like a bullet. So it's both a particle and a wave. But the crazy thing is, if you have one slot open and you fire a photon, if you have two slots open, you fire one photon, and the photon will make the wave pattern. It knows it's supposed to do the wave pattern with two slots and does it.
Right.
This seems to indicate that the universe at some level is conscious. I won't go so far as to say God and self-aware consciousness, but yeah. It does seem to prove that there's something going on there. So that's why I say I'm a cross between a non-practicing Taoist and a quantum physicist who can't do the math. So I actually at one point in the mid-1970s, I ran for county commissioner on a Taoist platform.
Really?
Yeah.
How did that go?
I got headhunted into the monastery before the election came up. And the
okay, now that's where I want to go. Where does the monastery recruitment come into this thing?
I hate to use the word Scientology. I was a Scientologist.
I saw that.
I was a Scientologist for a decade.
I saw that.
Yes, I was a Scientologist for a decade. If you read the book of poetry on my website, that was almost all of that was written while I was a Scientologist. And so it's Scientology viewpoint coming through in the poetry.
Got it.
Okay, so I tell everybody today I am out of the religion business. Okay, so I was in the Scientology monastery. I was working between 19 and 22 hours a day. I was being paid $17.20 a week. My W-2s proudly proclaimed that each year I was in the monastery, I made a three-digit income.
Wow.
Yeah. So I read, just to end off here on Scientology, the basic principle of Scientology is you cannot get this messed up in one lifetime. Scientology is all about past lives. It's all about past life regression.
Right.
It's a past life regression technology. And Trevor Ravenscroft's book, The Spear of Destiny, is all about past lives.
Exactly.
90% of that book is his contention that there was a cadre of black magicians in the 11th century that attempted to take over Europe by black magic means and failed, and that they have regrouped. They have rebirthed, they have come back around, reincarnated as the Nazi hierarchy, Himmler, Hitler, Goebbels, etc. That's Trevor Ravenscroft's contention. And so his book is all about the metaphysics of this spear that may have pierced the spear that pierced the side of Christ and may have taken on some power. And as he describes it, there's a scene. Supposedly Hitler, at about age 18 or 21, went into, he was working as a, he was not working, rather. He was living in a flop house and making his living by painting postcards and other sketches in Vienna. And one day he flies into a rage, rips up his sketchbook. It's a cold, blustery autumn day, and he goes into the closest building to get warm, which happens to be a museum. And as he's wandering through the museum, he's stopped by a tour group in front of a glass case. And the tour conductor is explaining that in the glass case is the spear that pierced the side of Christ. And a legend has arisen that whoever possesses this holy lance and understands the powers it serves, holds in his hand the destiny of mankind for good or evil. And then the tour group moves off, and Hitler comes up to the glass case, looks at the spear, and has a life-changing event. He suddenly sees himself in a past life as one of the kings of the Holy Roman Empire, as one of the kings of High Germany. And he is dressed in royal vestments, and he's holding the spear, and he's using it as his personal talisman to rule the Holy Roman Empire. And then he comes back to himself dressed in flophouse rags, wondering what the heck just happened to him.
Yeah.
Now, supposedly, this sent Hitler off on a personal crusade to verify if this thing in the glass case really was, A, the Spear of Christ, and really had some magic power. When David, my boss, David Hatcher Childress, called me and said, would you like to write a book on the subject? I had read Trevor Ravenscroft and was very interested in it. He sent me the Howard Buchner books, and they were, whoa, this is crazy stuff. This is intense. Yeah. And I went, wow, this is a great story. And so, right. And of course, David said, I want it in 6 months.
Of course.
Right. Now,
you know, as a publisher, right?
Right. And of course, you know, I have trouble getting out of the bathtub in 6 months.
Yeah, you know? I can relate to that.
So I tagged my best friend, George Picard. George Picard wrote the book Liquid Conspiracy, JFK, LSD, the CIA, Area 51, and UFOs. It's all about the aftermath of Operation Paperclip that brought Nazi spy masters and rocket scientists to the U.S. And we believe they then used the U.S. like a petri dish and cultured themselves and converted the Third Reich into the Fourth, which is currently in the White House. So we split the story up. George took the Nazi stuff, and he wrote about Hitler and Himmler and the Nazis and what they did with the spear. And I wrote the 2,000 years of history leading up to Hitler getting the spear. And then I wrote the wild, crazy stuff of the Buchner story and the urban legends about Admiral Byrd going to Antarctica and fighting the Nazis in Antarctica. So that's that kind of answers your question.
What do you mean, kinda? I could have made popcorn. Anyway, but hey, Jerry, listen, I'm telling you, I was enthralled by that. I really was. But I want to spend our last 20 or so minutes on your most recent project, and I want to read something here, and then I want us to discuss it. Now, this is about your book, Weather Warfare, The Military's Plan to Draft Mother Nature. And I just want to read something, and then I want to go into this with you. Quote, others are engaging even in an eco-type of terrorism whereby they can alter the climate, set off earthquakes, volcanoes remotely through the use of electromagnetic waves. Now, this was in April of 1997 by then United States Secretary of Defense William S. Cohen. And he says, Secretary Cohen made that statement at a conference on terrorism, weapons of mass destruction, and the U.S. strategy in his official capacity as a United States Secretary of Defense. Thus, this can be taken as an official position of the United States. Further, he used the word are, not could, might, or maybe sometime in the future. He further added, it's real, and that's the reason why we have to intensify our efforts. If the United States Secretary of Defense says that the earth and the sky have been turned into weapons and are being used at such in a present time that we have right now, then I believe we should take this statement very seriously. So what was this the catalyst that got you to do this book?
A bit. I had written the HARP book, and the HARP book, The Ultimate Weapon, The Conspiracy, really needed a follow-up, because what I had done here is I'd taken this one project and analyzed the heck out of this one project, and I realized that there was a whole lot more going on, and that it was just a piece of a bigger symphony, if you will. And so this is that I was working for. I've been trying to come up with the follow-up book for years, pulling bits of data together and pulling bits of data together. And when I ran into that quote from Secretary Cohen, that's when it hit me. Oh my gosh, this is the crux, the focus. And so I begin the book with that quote. It's actually quite a bit longer quote. And I then spend the next 400 pages asking whether or not it's true. Is Secretary Cohen speaking sooth, or is he just trying to stroke us to get some more bucks with the DOD? And I concluded that he was speaking the truth, that this indeed is the case. And so the book, Weather Warfare, is 400 pages of what I can prove. Now, from 1995 to present time, there are lots of wild stories on the Internet, lots of totally crazy things on the Internet, lots of conspiracy theories. And so what I did is I tried to do a roundup of all the conspiracy theories that I could find on the Internet and then give what I could prove or disprove about them. Many of them, there's a lot of fact behind the theory, and some of them is just, give me a break. No way. And so, there's a lot of people I really annoyed with this book by goring their pet cow.
Well, I have seen, I can't remember, I can't put my finger on it, because I'm a real science fiction nut, kind of like you are, Jerry. And I mean, there's not a movie that was science fiction that I didn't see, but there seems to me there was some movie, if I'm not mistaken, I think it was a James Bond movie, to where they were controlling the weather, and that's how they were manipulating and putting the world at ransom, if you will.
Well,
there have been
several movies like that. In fact, I'm holding one in my hand called, it was theatrically released as Storm, and then as a DVD, a Storm Tracker, with Luke Perry and Martin Sheen. This one is very low budget. It's not terrifically bright, but it's
a critique from a critiquer. What else? this isn't Siskel and Roper. Anyway,
one of the cool things about this is that in this movie, Martin Sheen is a deranged general who is going to, I forget, he's acquired a scientist with a weather control device, and he's going to use it in some fashion. It goes out of control and almost blows away L.A. with a Stage 7 hurricane. Now, the reason I mention this is that Martin Sheen also did another movie, which I highly recommend, about HARP. It's a nonfiction, it's a documentary film that trashes the HARP project. HARP, again, is the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program, the subject of my first book. And the movie is Holes in Heaven, which is a one-hour documentary, and this is an amazing film. It was shot by a woman using her credit cards and mortgaging her house to pay the thing.
Really?
And half of the production cost of it was I believe Martin Sheen donated his time to narrate the film. I think it's amazing that Martin Sheen in a couple of years plays somebody plays somebody doing what he said that was a bad thing to do.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. So,
well, you know,
I think there's a subtext to Storm Tracker that it's an attempt to wake up people to the problem of the military playing with weather control, and it's typical Hollywood low budget script by committee, so it keeps slamming its fingers in its own door, but it has its moments.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, not only do movies, you know, and I tell you what I find really amazing, Jerry, and I think because of your background and being a movie critic, if you will, but you know, don't you believe that a lot of the stuff that we see in movies nowadays, and I mean, you can name every science fiction movie you want to in the world, whether it's UFOs, ETs, whatever, but don't you think that there's a lot of people out there that have these agendas that they try to get things stirred up enough to where maybe people will get off their dead buttocks and care about what's happening around them. Are we to a point, Jerry, where we're so blind to what's going on around us that we just accept everything as status quo?
Yes and no. Yes and no. Yes, the majority of America are overwhelmed. They spend all their time They spend all their time going to work and working and coming home from work and dealing with the spouse and dealing with the children and dealing with the bills and the mortgage and the 700 channels with nothing on. And every day is just a struggle just to keep one's head above water. And you can't really think beyond. What does it take to get get the next paycheck? What does it take to get the next mortgage payment in? What does it take to get the child to stop screaming? You know, you get totally fixated in the everyday life, and it's very easy to get lost in that. It's very easy to decide to let other people solve the big problems. You know, we have I hate to say it, but most women, the women I know are either very politically active or want absolutely nothing to do with politics. They don't want to think about it for a minute.
Yeah, there's no gray area with them.
Yeah, and a lot of guys are willing to at least pretend there's a gray area. They're willing to be out there and say, well, you know, I support the candidate of my choice. And what does he stand for? Well, he stands for the same things I stand for. Well, what do you stand for? Well, I stand for the same things he stands for.
Is that like a non-denial denial?
Yeah, yeah. my biggest complaint about a life in America in the 21st century is that there are way too many people who are asleep. There are way too many people who are massively ill-informed. There are way too many people who are happy with being asleep and or massively ill-informed.
Well, let me change. I'm gonna change horses here for a second. Who was your hero growing up as a kid?
My heroes were Jack Parr and then Dick Gregory.
All right, you know who my hero was? I mean, really early that I really just was a real hero, and I'm excluding John Wayne that was kind of a hero growing up as a kid, but my real hero was Steve Allen. I loved Steve Allen and Ernie Kovacs.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I didn't see Ernie Kovacs until much later. In fact, I think probably the first time I saw him, he was already dead.
That's what I see. I do. My partner's always kidding me. He's always saying, you know, because I do some imitations sometimes, and every imitation that I do is of dead people. He one time asked me, he says, "Well, are the only guys you can imitate are dead guys?" I said, "Well, I guess so. I can't imitate the live ones, so I just, you know, kind of keep my expertise in the dead guys category."
Well, the Ernie Kovacs is a good one to imitate, since his half-hour show often didn't have more than six words in it.
And, you know, but that's the thing that made it funny, because he was really a sketch kind of guy, you know?
Right, physical comedy sketch.
Exactly. And, you know, that was one of the things that I really, growing up as a kid, I was a class clown, and I really got a lot of this stuff by watching Ernie Kovacs.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the monkey thing. Now, most people can look at that monkey thing and never get it, you know? But when he the monkey turns around and clobbers the other monkey on the head and he sucks that mask in, you know, I mean, I used to laugh out loud, and my mom and my dad and people that were hanging around going, what the hell's so funny? They didn't get it, you know. I mean, but it was that genius of Ernie Kovacs that really led me down the path that I just couldn't reverse. And that's one reason why I became a class clown and proud of that image till this day.
Yeah, you know, as a class clown, my the cross I got nailed to was Rusty, I forget his last name, Rusty Hamer,
Danny Thomas.
Make room for Danny, Daddy. Exactly.
Make room for Daddy, Danny,
you know,
Thomas.
He was that back-talking, wise-cracking, smart-aleck kid that I really, really wanted to be, and every time I was him, my father punched me.
Oh,
I can't tell you how many times my father and I had the exact same words, but Rusty Hamer said it. Yeah, well, he's on television. You're not. Smack.
Yeah, and popped you in the chops.
Yeah.
Oh, my Lord.
Yeah, I got the, when you get your own television show, you can say stuff like that, Lester, a few times.
Oh, man. Who really drew your respect as you were growing up as a kid? Adult or whatever?
Mostly people I never met. Mostly science fiction authors really drew my respect. Whenever I met a science fiction author at a conference or a convention or a club meeting, I tended to sit at their feet and bask in their glory. I can remember doing that quite a number of conventions. In terms of the guy who really, really kicked my ass the most was Dick Gregory. Dick Gregory was
I love Dick Gregory.
My greatest hero.
And I want to touch on that. I want to touch about your activism back in the Vietnam War, because you and I were pretty much wearing the same hat. I was doing the radio first termer in Saigon in 1971, talking about against the war in Vietnam and all the uprising that the troops were doing. And you were in the States with Dick Gregory. Tell me about the Dick Gregory stuff.
Well, I was of draft age and I guess my first consciousness, my first social consciousness, was hearing a Dick Gregory record. You know, Dick Gregory was a stand-up comic.
Yeah,
I
loved him too.
I think Dick,
he was ahead of his time. Oh, he was ahead of his time.
He was Richard Pryor without the foul mouth.
Exactly.
And he was brilliant. One of his lines that has just burned into my consciousness is a white man came up to him and said, you know, if you have to sit at the back of the bus, then I have to sit at the front of the bus, and I'd much rather sit at the back. And, you know, that's pretty much my attitude, is that I believe in freedom, and Dick Gregory espoused a moral point of view that permitted freedom. And I saw the world a little bit through his eyes in 64, 65. 64
right.
Was an election year. Of course, being a kid in a Democratic family, I was an LBJ man.
Of course.
And then after the election hoopla went down, I really started looking and reading beyond this. And of course, I'm reading as I'm a young teenager reading adult science fiction novels, and I don't read the action adventure nonsense. I read what really got me was the books about how technology impacted society, and how the society either dealt with the technology or went under because of it. You know,
yeah.
I've always been interested in the big picture stories, not just the guy with a zap gun. I mean, the guy with a zap gun never did anything for me. It was you know. So I was always much more into things like Strange in a Strange Land that were commentaries on what's wrong, what's messed up, why are so many people asleep. In the Vietnam era, initially I became when I was too young to be drafted, I was a civil rights activist. And then right. when I became old enough to get drafted, I suddenly became an anti-war activist. And Dick Gregory ran for president on the Peace and Freedom Party ticket. And right. I had been in love in a decent manly way with Dick Gregory for five or six years at this point, and I'm going, I have to work for Dick Gregory. And so and this was 1968 and I was 18, but they didn't change the law to make it legal for me to vote for another couple of years, so I couldn't vote until I was 21, even though etc. So it was horrifying to watch the 68 implosion of the Peace and Freedom Party, because the Peace and Freedom Party backed Eldridge Cleaver, who was not legally able to be the president. You have to be 35 per the Constitution. He was only 34. He couldn't right. become the president. It was just pissing away our efforts.
Right.
And so the Peace and Freedom Party split, but it was on the ballots in about 30 states. About 20 of them went Eldridge Cleaver. 10 of them went Dick Gregory. In California, it was Eldridge Cleaver where I was. So I worked with the Write Me In, Dick Gregory write-in campaign. And I bought and gave away a couple of cases of the book Write Me In. And, of course, it didn't work. And by this time, I had become a Taoist and had completely lost respect for virtually everything American. In 1968, if I could have resigned my American citizenship, I would have.
Boy, you have that much belief in it, huh?
Yeah, I there were a number of things that happened that year that really impressed me. One was at an anti-war rally, I got handed a flyer, an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper that proved that there had been a coup d'etat in America and that lawyers had taken over. and it's very simple. Who's in Congress? You know, congressmen, mostly lawyers. Who's in the Senate?
Right.
Virtually all
right.
lawyers. Who's the president?
Right.
A lawyer. What goes on in this country? It's all laws, and the laws are all written in things that, unless you're a lawyer, you have no clue what the law says.
Yeah.
You know, it's a closed club of by and for lawyers.
Right. Yeah, it's like going into the the highest legal system of the world, and just walking in there with a third grade reader. I mean, that's how I kind of look at the legal aspect of the thing. I mean, I can't understand 90% of what these clowns say, much less do.
Right. So that was my first introduction to conspiracy theory. Okay, so I got introduced to conspiracy theory, and then a really wild thing happened. I was living in Riverside, California, which had a Reuters machine. It was the only West Coast public, the only place on the West Coast where they had Reuters, which was the British news service. So every night I could watch on the TV, ABC, NBC, CBS, give me the body count. And then in the morning I could read the Riverside Press Enterprise, which had the Reuters British account of what had taken place. And they were always completely different.
The
Dan Blather says that Walter Cronkite says we killed 247 VC and one guy got a splinter. One of our guys got a splinter in his face.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And then we get the next morning you get the Reuters version, 9 VC were killed, 8 Americans were killed.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, I did 3 tours of Nob. So, I mean, you're preaching to the choir on that. I was stationed at Cameron Bay for a period of time, one of my tours, and I saw those military aircraft loaded with caskets. So, yeah, I mean, the thing that really upsetted me most about all that stuff was, as you say, the Stars and Stripes, which was the official military publication for the GI over in the Vietnam, was sitting here printing out one thing. And then I would get stuff from home from my mom and dad, and I'd go, wait a minute, this is completely different than what whatever. But, you know, still, the mainstream media in the United States was telling a different spin, a different story than those in the United Kingdom, those in Germany, those in France, et cetera. So, yeah, I totally are right there with you on that
right,
one.
So that was my second introduction to conspiracy theory. And then I got into the Scientology Monastery in 76, and Scientology teaches its staff members that Scientology is under attack. L. Ron Hubbard believed that there was a global conspiracy against Scientology, and he actually hired a PI to verify whether his theory was true or not. And the PI supposedly did verify that all the attacks on Scientology were coming out of one spot, which was the Bank of England. Curiously enough, the Bank of England is targeted as the bad guy on the planet by a number of organizations, including the John Birch Society.
Right.
One of the things that really spun me around in a good way was I read None Dare Call a Conspiracy by Gary Allen, and I highly recommend this book. Gary Allen was a L.A. Times staff writer. He was a dedicated liberal journalist who just got sick of the John Birch Society and decided to prove they were all lunatics. And so he gets their material, and then he systematically sets out to document how wrong they are and discovers, oh, my God, they're right. And
yeah.
And establishes from the I don't want to see this, but here are the facts. There was a global conspiracy to run the world of, by, and for the bankers. That the Federal Reserve Banking Act was the greatest piece of theft ever concocted by humans, and so far the Federal Reserve, which is not really a part of the United States government, the Federal Reserve Governing Board is a part of the government. The banks are privately owned. Mostly owned by foreigners. They've never been audited. The Federal Reserve banking system is where most of our national debt is owed. We have, I forget what it is now, something like $7, $8, $9 trillion. $5 or $6 trillion of that is owed to the Federal Reserve private banks for the privilege of operating our currency for us. And our Constitution clearly states that's not supposed to happen, that Congress is supposed to be operating our currency. But in the 236 years Congress has existed, they've actually only operated our currency 17 years of the whole time. They love to give our currency, our economy, over to anybody who will operate it for them, whether it's at a profit or a loss. It doesn't seem to much matter to the Congress critters. and so that was another kick in the oh pants. To where I began seriously. Oh, that same year I met Walter Bowart. Walter Bowart just died a few days ago. Walter Bowart wrote Operation Mind Control, which was an expose of the CIA's MK-Ultra program. And MK-Ultra was a mind control program that dumped MK-Ultra bought between 2 and 4 million hits of acid, originally from Sandoz and then from Eli Lilly, and dumped them on the street.
Oh, man.
And the CIA has admitted to this. I mean, this is a matter of congressional record at this point. So all of these things rather combined to set me on a everything you know is false pattern, and I have completely disbelieved. If the government tells me the sky is blue, I look out the window.
Yeah, and you know you're preaching to the choir, because I mean everybody that on AboveTopSecret.com, I mean our motto on that site is deny ignorance, and I mean there is so much ignorance in the world, you know, because people just simply don't question anything, you know. I mean, that's what drives the membership crazy, and me personally, because I've been so involved with it, and it's kind of grown on me. And that is, you know, we just accept that, you know, hey, that wall is white. Well, is it or is it not white? Well, it could be, and it could be something that we just happen to see because of XYZ or whatever. So, you know, conspiracy theories are abundant on AboveTopSecret.com, and I guarantee you everything that you have talked about, there is a topic thread somewhere on AboveTopSecret.com, because you're preaching to the choir when you're talking to our membership, Jerry.
Right, right. And that's a good thing. I hope I didn't bore anybody by telling them things they already knew.
No, I got news for you, because you really put a very interesting spin on a lot of things. But before I let you go, and I don't want you jumping off, because I want to talk to you off air just for a sec before I let you go. But the one last question that I have for you, and this is on the For Ladies Only site, but be calm. I'm not going to go into all the things that's there. The membership will have to go on there and look for themselves. But there's a picture of you having an ice cream cone at Steve Irwin's Australian Zoo when you were there in 2003 for the third annual International Scientific and Metaphysical Symposium. When you were there at the zoo, did you happen to have a chance to see Steve Irwin?
He was out of the country filming something at the time. His wife was there, but I didn't
Terry,
see her.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, that's got to be a magnificent
facility.
Oh, I didn't
care. I think she was pregnant at the time, and so she was at home doing the mommy thing.
Well, I think that must have been when she was pregnant with Bendy then, because that was 2003, and I think she was 5 or 6 or something.
Yeah,
right now.
Yeah. I'm not sure. It was a funny day. It was a drizzly day, and it was kind of cold and wet, and I was with a group, and the group could not get its stuff together. The group could not move. I mean, we would spend 20 minutes standing in one spot, move 10 feet, and spend another 20 minutes standing there. After about 45 minutes or an hour of progressing zero, I just said, I'll tell you what, you guys, I'll go off on my own and meet you back. And so I went, and I saw the whole zoo when they had gone two buildings. So I thought it was absolutely hilarious. And so I then acted as tour guide to show them the rest of the zoo that had already been there.
Because you had already seen it.
Yes.
And you know what? I'm laughing because I can identify with that. Everybody that's ever gone on any kind of tour group, I hate that. I want to take a 2x4 and beat the crap out of somebody. Because what they do is they try to stretch out and make it so boring when it could be so much fun just to get out there and do exactly what you did at the Australia Zoo.
It wasn't really – we weren't a tour group. What it was a group of several of the speakers and a couple of special guests and some kids. And so we had the organizer of the conference and I think it was four of the speakers. And one of the speakers was Dr. Roger Lear, who is a podiatrist.
We know Roger real well. Okay. We've interviewed Roger. Yeah.
So Roger was having locomotion problems, and he had to be in a wheelchair. So his preteen daughter was pushing him around. So there was all this: get the wheelchair, get him in the chair, we can't go up the steps. Where's the ramp? You know, all this stuff. And then among the speakers was I've just gone blank. The movie Fire in the Sky. Walton.
Travis
Walton. God, Travis Walton is a really nice guy. I really enjoyed his company, and his wife Dana is the most spectacular, drop-dead, beautiful blonde grandmother I've ever seen. I have never seen a grandmother look that good in a miniskirt.
Oh, all right, well, wait a minute. Well, while we're there, on Jerry's scale of 1 to 10, how does she rate?
Oh, well, I don't use that scale.
Oh, what? Well, what, 1 to 100?
You're probably going to cut this out, but I'll give it to you anyhow. The scale I use is a logarithmic scale. It's like the Richter scale. And it's open ended, but for the way it basically works is a zero is there's absolutely no condition, including her being the last woman on Earth, that would ever get the two of us in bed. A one is coyote ugly. A one is you know what coyote ugly is.
I know exactly what I've
a one is
dated
you never
a few coyote
admit
ugly
to being in bed with her, but you've done
it a couple
of times.
Oh, yeah.
A two is she's two something. Too fat, too stupid, too ugly, too young, too old. If she's two something, she's a two. Now, on my scale, a 3 is what on the 1 to 10 scale would be a 5. That's completely nondescript. The average housewife that the supermarkets are filled with, you never turn your head. I mean, it's just a nondescript female. A 4 right. is you turn your head. A 5 is you give yourself whiplash turning your head. A 6 is lust at first sight. a 7 is it's hard to describe a 7 because your brain boils and you don't really remember what it is. An 8 is this is just about perfect. 8 is everything you ever wanted. A 9 feels the same way about you.
Ah.
So on my scale, the 9 is the highest, which is about an 18 or a 20 on the 1 to 10 scale.
Okay, so the grandmother's rating is on Jerry's scale.
Dana is an easy 5.
Ah, wow. And you're wrong. I am going to leave that in because because I think it's a great one. I had never heard that one before, but I like that scale, Jerry.
I made that up. I keep meaning to write it up. I've been meaning to write that for 30 years and just never got around to it.
Well, at least the fan base of AboveTopSecret.com is going to get to enjoy it.
Okay,
and I know
and somebody out there is going to write it up and
and plagiarize
that's right,
your
and
scale.
And there goes the $150 I could have gotten for that article.
Oh, I don't know when I've had so much fun with a guest, Jerry. You've been really the top of your game with this one, man. I'm telling you, it was a hoot. But I want you to hang on because I wanted to say a few words to you off air. So for those of you that have enjoyed this special edition of the ATS Mix, please go to the show thread. And if you like something or if you had questions of Jerry or whatever, obviously you can go to Jerry's website at www.jerryesmith.com. That's Jerrye Smith, SMITH.com. And it's just an amazing site it's got. You can order his book. You can look at all the things that Jerry's done, the articles, the poetry, his biography. And if you are a lady, we would like to direct your attention to For Ladies Only. And it tells some intimate insider information about Jerry. And if you get down to the bottom, down to the crocodile part, then he has additional things. If he hadn't scared you off, in his own words, if he hadn't scared you off by the time you get down to the crocodile hunter, then you're a possible date for him. Hey, and by the way, Jerry, before I let you go, you need to put that scale up on the website. I swear, that is hilarious. I love that. Anyway, I hope everybody's had a good time. I know I have, and Jerry, I can't thank you enough for your time and for the humor and just the great subject matter. Boy, this is such a great show. I just can't wait to put it up on the feeds and on the internet for millions of people to enjoy it just as much as you and I have. So until next time, this is Dave Rabbit, and on behalf of AboveTopSecret.com and the Above Network LLC, we'll see you next time on the ATS Mix. Hi, everybody. Dave Rabbit here with the ATS Mix Show from AboveTopSecret.com. When I get ready to relax after doing a long show, I enjoy going to our sister site, BelowTopSecret.com. They have some great forums there, some of which include rants, jokes, puns, and pranks, which is one of my favorites, faith and spirituality, relationships, travel and vacations. They even have a freshman forum for you newbies and rookies. I especially enjoy the music, television, fantasy, and science fiction forums, as well as comics, music, member art, and, of course, video games. But my absolute all-time favorite is cool websites. And I want to tell you why. As everyone knows, I do not read. On cool websites, the membership at BelowTopSecret.com has done the work for me. They've researched the World Wide Web and found very interesting sites. All I got to do, go into the forum, click, and I am at an interesting and very cool website. So when you get through listening to that last ATS Mix show, come join me at BelowTopSecret.com, part of the Above Network LLC. Remember, deny boredom, BelowTopSecret.com.
AtsMix.com.
ATS Mix from AboveTopSecret.com is over.
You've been listening to the ATS Mix with Dave Rabbit. If you have a comment, suggestion, an opposing view, or would like to participate in a future show of ATS Mix, please contact Dave at www.AboveTopSecret.com. The views expressed on ATS Mix do not necessarily reflect those of the staff and management of the Above Network, LLC, or any of its affiliates. Thanks for listening. You may now reattach your tinfoil hat.